Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State has been sued by an associate of the white nationalist Richard Spencer. That took place. They filed it in federal court on Sunday. The suit comes after Spencer threatened to take OSU and the University of Cincinnati to court if they refused to make space for him to speak on their campuses. The University of Cincinnati agreed, but OSU on Friday issued a letter saying that citing substantial risk to public safety as well as material and substantial disruption to the work and discipline of the university. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Statehouse reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Glad to be here.
Reporter for Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
And Statehouse correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome as always.
Hi, Ann.
So Spencer wasn't invited by an organization on campus, but they're going to public universities and colleges and asking, you know, requesting to rent space. And that's what OSU is denying Spencer the right to do. Last Thursday, he was at the University of Florida. They spent over $500,000 on security there alone.
Right.
Do you think it's worth it to OSU, or is OSU betting that it's worth it to save some money in the long run by spending money in court now? Joe?
Well, let's face it. OSU has deep pockets when it comes to being able to defend a lawsuit. So I don't think that they were sitting there going, oh, well, if we go to court, is this going to, you know, be a problem for us? I don't think they had that. But I think the big thing is that, you know, especially out of Charlottesville, we saw that situation and we saw that turn very violent. And in fact, we had one person that died from that. There were more people who were injured in that. The events in Florida, as I read about them, weren't nearly as violent. There were no deaths. But, you know, spending $500,000 or more on security, that does raise some questions for universities that already are finding it's hard to provide some of the services for students that they want to provide. And, you know, you've got this situation where the First Amendment gives these speakers the right to speak there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are there, there are a lot of people who feel the compunction that they should be there to protest. And so all of a sudden you have a big situation set up where you've got, you know, security being front and center as a huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the answer is on that, but I think that Ohio State is saying, you know, let's just wait on this. Let's go ahead and let them sue us and we'll defend it.
Yeah.
Right. And it does pit these two high interests, the First Amendment and safety of students particularly. I mean, we're the home of Kent State University and you know, great historical relevance there to the fact that we've had a lot of violence in times of protests in this country that can be bloody. So I understand, you know, both sides of it. I do think what the point you made at the start, which is that this is a deliberate series of requests by them to both get on these campuses and then also be very ready to sue, I think is a public relations type move on their point, on their part. It's organized, and the suits are coming. They're threatened, and then they're coming when the universities make decisions against them.
You know, the courts have already ruled that OSU can't charge Richard Spencer the cost of security for such an event, that that's just prohibited by law because
right.
It would be an undue burden.
Right. And so that's why they don't want to eat the cost. They don't want to worry about the security. I mean, it is a very interesting debate that's going to be had. I mean, his representative has already successfully sued Auburn University over this. He's also filed lawsuits already against Penn State and Michigan State. I think he was threatening a lawsuit against Cincinnati, but they're not going to allow him.
Yeah.
So this is clearly going to become a I wouldn't be surprised eventually to see one of these cases make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you're going to have a pretty – my guess is at the end of the day, you're going to have a somewhat of a landmark ruling on the First Amendment and the balance between that and and the protection of students on a campus. I mean, this is not just we're going to gather at the public square. I mean, this is actually on a campus, where students are entitled to a right of security as well.
Well, you have to remember, Ann, that this is at the time when higher education is sort of under assault by the very far right as too liberal.
A bastion of liberals, yeah.
Right, and that basically a point is trying to be made here that, hey, you know, many people are allowed to come onto campuses and speak, and we don't have the freedom to do so. Some would argue that these are different kinds of groups. These are groups that, are preaching exclusion of large sectors of the population, and that that is invokes a lot of anger and higher risk than maybe some other, I don't know, boring student group that wants to go talk on the Ohio State Oval. But it does come as part of that larger conversation. I just saw a story over the weekend on this very point. Are colleges too liberal? Are they teaching kids not to believe in religion and turning them into Democrats and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's been an on, like you said, Julie. Yeah. That's been an ongoing kind of a this. It's one of the causes that the right has taken up lately. I mean, there's a bill that's been introduced in the state legislature by some of the more conservative members of the House that would essentially stop Ohio State and most pretty much any other campus from blocking these types of things. Basically, trying to set up a law that would. That would prevent them
take the power from the university.
Let these folks come on.
Well, the big caveat on that, though, is that the students would have to be the ones. It would have to be a student group that invited that speaker.
Yeah, the judge ruled against Auburn and allowed Spencer to speak as planned. And I guess the question is, why would OSU be any different? I guess it's a matter of figuring out which argument against allowing a Spencer or a Spencer-like speaker to come on campus, someone who would attract that much attention and require that much security, you know, what the argument will be that would get it to the Supreme Court, I guess, if enough stack up. But
right, because you would think it looks like a clear free speech issue,
yeah.
And they have very good lawyers, as Joe mentioned before, and I'm sure they have ideas. I don't know what they would be, though.
But the freedom of speech doesn't allow you to yell fire in a movie theater.
No, it's
so,
not. Ultimately,
you know,
it's not.
Right.
So
there
this
are
could
some
be that case. Yes.
Yeah, there are some arguments there that could be made. Like you said, it's just getting the right argument that the court will say, "Yep, okay, that's okay. We'll go with that."
Yeah. I'll also say too that when these types of things get a lot of publicity and there's a lot of concern ahead of time about, you know, are there going to be protesters or is there going to be violence, it tends to fizzle out a little more. I think like Charlottesville, I don't remember hearing anything about Charlottesville before it actually happened. I think that was when that's the type of thing, when these things spring up and people aren't already ready for it, that's when you get the violence. That's when you get the problems with security. But I think, you know, Wake with Florida, I think there was more security and media down there than there were protesters. And I can speak, that was the same at the Republican National Convention last summer.
That's right.
It was, you know, there was all this worry that there'd be all these violent, you know, protests. And it turned out there was most of the time more media waiting around than there were actual people protesting.
And I remember, too, back in the, I believe it was the 90s, when at the Ohio State House, the KKK used to come down there and do their rallies. And at first it was getting these big crowds coming out and protesting. And, you know, it got kind of crazy down there. But then it seemed to fizzle out after a while. And at the end of it, I remember some churches were putting the little crosses on the lawns instead of mounting a protest. They were doing that. And then the Capitol Square Review and Advisory Board, which is over the State House grounds, made some rules to try to keep that situation from happening again as far as how you can congregate on State House grounds. So there are ways that you get around it. And one thing is just time, actually, letting time pass.
Right. And I think that if we think about maybe Ohio State invoking some sort of seminal First Amendment case here, you know, it may surround hate speech, playing into a movement of unrest in the country. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which we're in a very unique time, as we all know, and it would be interesting to see what sort of legal parameters they see on that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, also with us, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. There is a plan to bolster Ohio's unemployment compensation system that would require worker contributions. That would be a first for Ohio. Ohio would be the fourth state to do this, I believe. What are the chances in the General Assembly?
Well, it looks like they're pretty good at this point, because you've got some groups that would normally oppose this sort of thing, and they're either sitting on the sidelines or saying, yeah, they got to do something. Mm-hmm. But for the workers, this is going to be, it could be a pretty substantial increase. And so, you know, I think 51% of the funding would eventually come from workers, as that's the number that I read. So, I mean, you're talking about workers putting in quite a bit of money into the system. And for some workers, that might be, you know, workers who really are struggling, that might be hard. You know, we always talk about, I always crack up when I hear people say nominal fees, you know, like, oh, this is a nominal fee and it's only $20. But, you know, I kind of laugh because I'm like, you know, $20, that's nominal to some people, but it's not nominal to everyone.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a fix. It's sliding scale.
Yeah, it would be sliding scale. But still, I mean, you know, if you're on that bottom rung or even the next to the bottom rung, and, you know, you might not be able to afford an extra $10, $15. I mean, it's just seeing how that will play out will be a key issue, because I just don't think that I think there's probably going to be a little bit of a fight over it.
You know, the left-leaning Progress Ohio has said that they think that workers could contribute even some. So it does look pretty bipartisan.
It does.
Well, that part of it is, yes, there is an understanding among the labor supporters and the unions that they are going to have to contribute something. And they feel this is a better option than getting benefit cuts on the back end. They don't want, they'd rather have their employees paying $50 a year in new in these new payments rather than seeing benefit unemployment benefits cut when they're laid off. But there's more to it than that in this bill. This is going to have a really hard time passing no matter what they do. And under its current form, the Senate Republicans have already said we're not passing this bill in its current form.
Why is that?
Well, they're not saying, but I mean, look, they're trying, you know, Representative Kirk Schering in the House, who was put in charge of this by the Speaker, basically they had like 19 meetings or something behind closed doors between all the parties.
Right.
And I think at some point you just got to say, look, you guys are, you know, labor and business, you're refusing to get off your positions and you're refusing to compromise. So fine, I'm going to throw a bill out there that seems to split the difference between you in terms of the cost. And when we talk about the cost, what we're talking about is shoring up the fund so that it doesn't go into debt the next time we hit a
recession.
So they
don't have to borrow from the feds again and then pay interest for 100 years.
Exactly. So basically now you have both sides who are not happy with the bill. You've got labor who's not happy mainly because there's a 10-year freeze on benefits. The benefits will not increase for 10 years. And in addition, they'll be paying a little extra. Businesses aren't happy because what they pay will also go up per employee. And so both sides are not happy. And I don't know, you know, when that happens in an issue like this, some might say, well, then maybe it's a good bill and it'll pass. You know, or maybe it won't pass because no one wants to have the political courage to tell either side that, no, we're just going to have to stick it to you.
We're, you know, 9 years away from the last big recession. That means we're coming up on the next, you know, dip in employment. They got to do something, right, Julie?
Yes. And that's what's interesting about this is these are just very practical fiscal matters that states have to deal with. And they're not sexy. They're not political. They're not really something you can get onto a flyer to elect your next senator or representative. but they need to be done. They help the government function. And so I think in that way, it is a critical time period, and they're at least seeing that some sort of give and take from each side is important. And as these guys are laying out, I mean, each side has had to give something here, you know, with the payments going in and the benefits being frozen. And, you know, these are frozen but not completely eliminated or cut. So that gives a little window to see how that might play out fiscally.
And Julie kind of brings up a good point there. If you're going to anger the business side or the labor side or both sides, you at the end of the day, it really helps if you get some political benefit out of it. Well, like Julie just said, there really is none, because at the end of the day, all you're going to say is, hey, we made sure this fund doesn't go broke again. Right. And for most people, they're just,
We're charging everyday people more money.
Right. Basically, we're just saying, hey, we're going to keep this fund going. And there's not a big political win in that.
It'll take
you a
60-second commercial just to explain what it
but
is.
But if they don't do it.
Right. That could be.
Well, if they don't do it, what ends up businesses end up paying more, because then they end up having to pay a surcharge to the federal government to pay back the debt.
The interest,
and that's also part of this discussion, is because labor knows that when this fund goes in the debt, it's not the workers who end up paying; it's the business owners. So they are they have less incentive to want to really get in there and do a 50-50 compromise, because they're like, hey, if we do nothing, then you guys will have to absorb all the cost anyway. And so there's just a lot of factors and a lot of political considerations, not the least of which is the fact that the trade unions have been dumping a lot of campaign money in the last few years into Republican coffers to make to ensure that they have some good standing on issues just like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A year ago, Congressman Pat Tiberi was bandied about as a potential GOP candidate for Senate. Now he's leaving Congress to lead the Ohio Business Roundtable. Tiberi has served 9 terms in the U.S. House, where he has gained seniority status on key committees. But there have been disappointments in recent years. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe, Ohio State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel, and a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Joe Ingles. Pat Tiberi, what was the tipping point, do we think?
I think it's a combination of things.
It was maybe
a perfect storm of the fact that this was an amazing job opportunity. Many people wanted it. Okay. Richard Stoff had been in there 25 years. It pays very well. And it's policy oriented for those who are pretty sick of politics, which I think is factor number 2. Obviously, moderate Republicans in Washington are not getting things done. Many
As
of
planned.
Them, right. And many of them are risking really hostile sort of Twitter attacks from the president, who gets increasingly frustrated by things like not being able to repeal Obamacare, not being able to, we're waiting to see, push a tax overhaul through, these kind of things. So Tiberi is a moderate. He sits on the Ways and Means Committee and I think would like to stay there for that tax overhaul. And then part 3, from what we understand, is just he's got family considerations. His mother died recently. His father's not well. He's got a big family.
4 kids,
triplets. And so all those things, I think, probably work together.
And there's another issue here. Pat Tiberi is in a heavily gerrymandered district. If you look at it, it does this weird thing where it goes out and takes just a little part of Franklin County on each edge, and then it takes Delaware County and Licking County, and I think it goes all the way out to Zanesville at some point. But it's in a really kind of weird you know, if
well,
you look
it's
at it on the map.
Yeah.
And right now they're talking about revising, you know, the way that the congressional districts are drawn. And that's a big thing because we've got a House or a legislative proposal that's going to be coming out. We've also got a group that's trying to put that on the ballot next year.
Mm-hmm.
So with those two things, if he doesn't have the protection of gerrymandering, if that 12th district changes, it might not be as solidly Republican as it has been. And that could play into this decision as well.
Central Ohio is, and all of Ohio's cities tend to lean more Democratic. And he obviously represents portions of the urban area, as Joe says, mm-hmm. but it would be one that might be likely to.
Okay.
To switch more than others. Right now, it's 68% Republican index, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he has the parts of Franklin County he has are the Republican suburbs right. up in the north and
Genoa Township,
yeah.
Westerville.
Yeah. He's gotten some of those areas. He's
safe for now.
Yes. But, you know, he's got Delaware County, Richland County, you know. Morrow County, Licking County, a number of solidly Republican
right.
counties out there that also, which is going to make it interesting to see who fills in to replace.
That's
him.
What my mm-hmm. next question was: is who's going to fill in the replacement? Because whoever does is going to have to take on the yoke of whatever congressional redistricting might be afoot in the future.
Right. We've seen Delaware County Prosecutor Carol O'Brien has already come out and said she's interested, but we've got a lot of people out there who are also kind of expressing interest, haven't come out publicly so much, you know, and it'll be interesting to see if they go with someone who is someone who has more of a local position, or if they go with someone, who maybe has more of a statewide notoriety in politics, something like that,
right.
in a business.
It would reach down to potentially local office holders in Franklin County,
right.
City of Columbus. We've seen some of the state lawmakers who represent areas of it, Kevin Bacon, Chris mm-hmm. Jordan.
Jim Hughes.
Yeah.
It's an open – I mean, it's an opportunity that hasn't been out there for a while now. For some people chomping at the bit to move up the food chain.
Right. Mm-hmm. These opportunities don't come up around very often, especially an open seat like this where it's not going to be a traditional just primary and general election. I mean, there's going to be special elections just for this this seat, and that can bring out all kinds of weird turnout in terms of, you know, just exactly who's going to show up at the polls just to vote for this
you know,
district.
It's hard to believe that how many he's been 9 terms.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a neophyte anymore. He's considered a key member of the Ohio delegation,
right.
sits on key committees. I mean, that does affect the Republican. Well, I mean, we call it the Ohio. It's Republican delegation. It's the Ohio delegation primarily. Does it matter really, though?
Yes, it does. I was with some movers and shakers in the Delaware community the other night at an event, and a lot of them were kind of surprised at this move. They didn't expect it. And one of the concerns is that he brings a lot of money back to the district in the form of federal assistance for projects that are needed. And you've got to remember that Delaware County is a growing county. It has a lot of needs, he's able to get the money that is needed to bring that back to the district. The question is, if you get someone in there who doesn't have that political clout, mm-hmm. will they be able to bring the money back into the district?
But how has his clout fared in recent months? I mean, he's establishment. He's conservative by any measure.
Right.
He's also establishment.
I think he got involved in a what was the name of the coalition, the caucus that he started?
I don't know. Yeah,
something like
Let's get some work done. Yeah, it's pretty sad when you got to create a caucus that's just for governing. Yeah. Hey, we want to actually do things.
Our job.
But that was a form of clout, I guess, to say, hey, maybe there's some critical mass here of people, but. You know, we also have a very divided state. I mean, Jim Jordan is at the in the high ranks of the Freedom Caucus, and that is a much more conservative group. Now, Democrats, we haven't mentioned any, but you know, they might hop in here if they see that the Republicans are going to run somebody particularly conservative. I don't know if they feel like they want to spend some money to try to fight a moderate.
Well, that'll be interesting because no matter what, they'll have to. I mean, if they don't run the right person, they could face a primary challenger next year when the seat's up for re-election. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got to pick carefully on that score. If they pick. And if they pick the wrong or the right person, depending, will affect the, whether the Democrats put anything into it. However, there is a lot of money and in Tiberi's campaign coffers, like something like $6.1 or $6.2 million. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of money. I mean, what happens to that?
Right.
Well, it can be passed over to another candidate. Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably where it will go. And but, you know, I think when you talk about the Democrats, I know last week David Pepper, the head of the Ohio Democratic Party, told me that he sees this as an opportunity. But up there, really, there aren't many, if any, Democrats that have been elected in recent years. Usually Democrats don't do very well on a ballot. So it would take a lot of money, I would think, to be able to actually wage a contest up there. And I don't know if under the current system, if they would want to put that kind of money out there.
We do have J.D. Vance. His name is being bandied about. He's
the
author of Hillbilly Elegy.
Right.
And he's quite visible on cable TV and that kind of thing as a pundit, and
but he doesn't really live in that district now. I mean,
he's in German Village.
He's in German Village now, and that's not part of that district. So.
Right. So I mean, the thing is, as we were talking about Franklin County, I mean, so many people could move within this county. And the interesting there would be, my guess would be, if he ever were successful in getting elected, he might only be there say one term. You know, because maybe he'd go on to something else.
Yeah.
I mean, if he is a rising type figure for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think Vance will eventually run for something. His people have told us he's not running for this seat, but doesn't mean he can't change his mind. But there are definitely. I think there's going to be a number of candidates who jump in. You're going to see a lot of this district spans a number of counties, and you're going to have a number of county officials. Who are able to run from cover, meaning that they're able to run next year for this seat. And if they lose, they can still keep their current seat because they're also not on the ballot for their current seat. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a number of folks jumping in just because of that. And, you know, local folks and their families and their local officials are telling them that they're the best and they should be the ones who step up and do it. And so I think you're going to see a mixture of some of your more establishment folks, maybe like a state senator, Kevin Bacon, I know is looking very hard at it. So you're going to have folks like that. But I think you're going to maybe see some. I wouldn't be surprised to see more prosecutors and county commissioners or you know, bigger city mayors step in and try to make a run at it as well.
I think they're going to have a hard time, though, if they don't have at least some Delaware County ties, because that's where a lot of the money in that district is. Mm. And that's where you're going to be raising a lot of your money for a campaign. And I think they're going to have some sort of tie to Delaware County to be able to raise the dollars that they want.
Yeah, I know Representative Andrew Brenner is not going to run for it.
Right.
Senator Chris Jordan he's on kind of on the fence. I don't know, maybe not. Representative Rick Carfagna is looking at it pretty seriously, although, he's just getting started as a state legislator, but he may have an interest as well. So
hasn't stopped others from reaching higher.
Right, and we did see, now I can't remember the exact figure, but when John Boehner stepped down, I think that primary was, nine people or something like that?
Yeah, it was
a lot.
Big.
Yeah, this is going to be
big,
too.
But they're going to pick a replacement who's going to have an advantage going into an election year, right?
Well, in the primary, the voters will.
The voters will.
In the primary, the voters will.
Yeah.
But whoever replaces, he's quitting a year early.
Right, right.
Yeah,
the voters will pick a replacement in the primary in May.
Oh, okay.
And then that
gotcha.
Person will go on in November. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, actually, they might do more than that. I thought they could do like up to four elections next year.
Well, they could. They could.
I mean,
I
think we're waiting for Kasich to tell us what he wants to do.
Right.
He can actually determine how to set up a special election process here.
And
to be honest,
he's a Kasich guy.
Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, to be honest, it would make sense to hold the special election and the regular primary on the same day.
Right.
So that you don't have to double up all that work. But I don't know that that's where they're heading.
I think the assumption is that it would be in May. But Governor Kasich could set a special date.
But if that were the case, then there might have to be a special general election before the general next year, because if it were right. if they waited till November, the person would only have 2 months right. before the end of the term. Do I have that right?
Our voters,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the issue here is that you have a you have an entire district of people who will not be represented in Congress, and
right.
they always want to, you want to avoid that in a mm-hmm. in a democracy as much as possible. So there's different considerations to weigh in here.
There mm-hmm. are provisions for the congressional office would remain open. People could still call there and have their constituent issues dealt with, but those folks would not have a vote.
Congress will still be as dysfunctional as ever, with or without Pat Tiberi.
Were you guys surprised that Tiberi did this? I mean, not just that he's still young.
I wasn't personally, because look, you don't form up a caucus to govern, become a governing caucus if you don't or if you aren't recognizing that you've got a problem with governing. And look, Pat Tiberi, I think is he's a mainstream Republican, and at the end of the day, do you really want to go through the grind of traveling out to Washington over and over again, staying out there and being away from your family, and then not get anything done? Have to deal with Donald Trump all the time. Have to deal with factions in your own caucus that much less the Democrats who are never with you. I mean, I think it just grew on him and grew frustrated, he's been there a long time. I mean, after a while, you look at a great new job at the Business Roundtable and say, hey, it's time to try something else and get a big pay raise.
Okay. I thought maybe he would go. I thought he'd leave, but I also thought he'd go to a higher office or go into a different. I didn't, I never thought, oh, he'll go to the Business Roundtable. That wasn't a thought.
Right. And I just one other thing that we haven't mentioned, it might be a long shot, but certainly what besides gerrymandering and everything that's going on currently, what will happen in the next cycle, and will Republicans even be in the majority? As Jim mentions, how frustrating it is to be in the majority and not get anything done. I was thinking about the people who are in the minority who also trudge out there all the time and try to keep their agendas going.
We are having our weekly reporters roundtable right now. We've been talking about prospects. Well, you know what the prospects are for U.S. Congressman Pat Tiberi, a Republican from Genoa Township. He is going to work with the Ohio Business Roundtable as its executive director, as its president.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A slot that hasn't opened up for about 25 years, so it's good for him. But what's going to happen to that House district? That's what we've been talking about, and we'll continue to talk about in weeks to come. We will return with more. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Aside from their shared blue-collar Pennsylvania roots, former Democrat Vice President Joe Biden and GOP Governor John Kasich have little in common, but they agreed that partisanship in Washington has gone too far. Last week, the two sat down to talk about how to bridge the divide. Both blame base politics for part of the problem.
The system itself has been breaking down because of base politics. Why did Democrats go out of the window on health care? Well, because if you don't stand behind Obamacare, Bernie and the boys will come and get you. And if you're a Republican and you try to cross the base of the Republican Party, they come get you in a primary.
So what's happening? Both political parties are moving more to the extremes. Yeah. The center is shrinking. And that doesn't mean the center per se is good. But God, how can you run this country without reaching a consensus? The system is built in a way it's not possible.
Okay, these guys sound desperate. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Kerr-Smythe, Ohio State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, Joe Engels. What does this tell us about, let's just say, John Kasich, what he's up to? He's spending a lot of money being briefed on international politics and international public affairs. He still has a guy on retainer to do his communications for him. These guys that were with him during his bid for the Republican nomination for president. Now he's going on stage with Joe Biden. You know, Joe Ingles, you're nodding like, yeah.
I think he would like to, you know, he says he's not running for president. That's what he says. His actions.
Well, they never are until they are.
Yeah. But his actions certainly appear like someone who could be persuaded to be drafted into the presidential race at some point. And I'm not completely sold that he won't run for president again. You know, that's political. I think what this speaks to is we were talking about it earlier with the congressional seat, this whole redistricting problem. There is the redistricting, without it, what you have right now, at least on the congressional side, is you have the parties basically controlling who gets in that seat. And so in order to win a primary,
instead of the voters.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So instead of the, you know, instead of winning a primary, it all happens at the primary because the general election, they've got it set up to the point that the candidate, you know, that got the primary vote in the heavily Republican or heavily Democrat district, that candidate's going to get elected in the general. So when you push everything back to the primary, then you start getting people, you know, that are more conservative or more liberal than the actual middle. And I think that speaks to exactly what they're talking about there.
You mentioned in your intro that they don't have a lot in common. I guess I feel like they have in common that they're roughly the same age. They've served in Washington for and during an era that spanned 30 years or more,
right,
in which partisan politics has definitely changed. Back when, even when I started at the State House 17 years ago, I mean, there were election cycles and there was governing. That doesn't happen anymore. It honestly does not. We can all attest that we get an email the day after an election about the next election. That did not happen before.
Right.
And people are hired. People are working. It was certainly always the DCCC and the RGA and all the different groups were always working. That was their job. But in terms of the visioning, if I can call it that, toward the next election, it really never ceases.
And with President Trump, it seems to me like he's going out on campaign rallies. I mean, that's
right.
What it certainly feels like with some of these events.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so it makes it more and more fractious. It makes it some of the things we've been talking about earlier about unemployment compensation and very basic government hard work, nose to the grindstone, just type compromises that take a lot of concentration and effort and compromise. It's difficult to get people to focus on that between term limits and the fact that term limits at the state level and the fact that people are always running.
And I know that I know there are a number of Democrats in Ohio who, when they watched John Kasich talk about the need for more bipartisanship, roll their eyes pretty hard.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that was a forum where you had one person who's not in office anymore and the other person runs a state that is heavily Republican controlled, all of one party.
Completely Republican.
And so there's no, you know, neither one of them is at this point faced with the need to work in a bipartisan manner. And Democrats in this state will argue that John Kasich has absolutely not done that over his career, at least to any consistency. So, you know, talking about it is one thing, but like Joe said, gerrymandering is a terrible problem. I mean, as long as we have 16 congressional districts in this state and zero competitive districts in this state, then you're never going to get rid of this partisan problem. You're also not going to get rid of it as long as people are so strongly devoted to things like, you know, to their own viewpoints on the news. If all you're watching is Fox News, or MSNBC, you have a very different worldview than what is probably the reality. You have a very different idea of what's important and what's not. And so those things make it very hard to find compromise. And then you've got powerful groups like the NRA who have no interest in even the slightest compromise, who are fighting against that. And the whole system right now is just geared toward fighting and not geared toward anybody seeing the benefits of bringing everyone together and working on actual policy that maybe actually makes people's lives better.
Totally. That's true.
Right. And I think that we could look at it, if John Kasich decides not to run, that these are two people who have been in government a long time, looking back at their careers and sort of wanting to be a voice of some kind of historical reference to the younger people who are in there, to the partisan people, to the public. I mean, they're trying to send a message that there's a chance it's not political. There's a chance that they're trying to make a policy point. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah.
But it's just a little tiny chance.
But, you know, I'd love to hear some with what some of our millennial voters, millennials think about the current state of politics, because, you know, I have a very select group around me because I teach young people, and they're just very, very disgusted, the ones that I'm around. You know, they feel like government doesn't represent them. Why do they bother voting? You know, this, you know, that kind of thing.
But that's been time immemorial. There have always been a low voter turnout in that group.
And, right. But you don't hear the
situation normal.
Right. But the politicians don't speak to their issues, and they're not even trying to speak to a lot of their issues. You know, student debt and, and those kind of things, they're not speaking to that. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, government that's broken. Well, if we're not including that generation in this discussion, I mean, I think that's, you know, I know old people vote. People who pay a lot of taxes vote. We get that. But, you know, young people, they could vote if they saw a hope somewhere, but I don't think that they see anyone, you know, working on their behalf in general, and they're not very inspired to get out there to go to the ballot box.
I wonder, though, if that's is that a chicken or the egg? Or, you
right.
know, because you say, well, we're not going to vote because you're not speaking to our issues. And then the politicians say, well, why should I bother focusing on your issues
right.
if you're not even going to vote?
Right.
So
right.
I mean, that's just a self-defeating.
That's been going on for a long time, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
oh, yeah. This is not new. This has long been how politicians treat the 18 to 30 year old class of voters. They just, you know, it's like, okay, well, you're not going to make or break me as a politician, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of my time worrying about your issues.
That's true. So, that's true. But I think, you know, when we're talking about having all these different points of view, I think that's the one that's definitely missing that could make a difference, actually, to someone if them inspired.
Oh, yeah. It's the largest.
I mean,
it's the biggest group.
You get them inspired. You get them moving on something. I mean, people can do a lot of things.
Well, and focusing on their issues also would probably force you to focus on things that are actually long-term solutions to things rather than just what tax break can I give today that might balloon the debt later, and we're not going to worry about that.
But the other interesting thing about this bipartisan hammering away that we're hearing from Kasich and folks like Biden is it presumes partisan, period. I mean, we're in a time when you're talking about these young people, the idea of a political party is actually kind of eroding.
Right.
And so in some ways, these are the bastions of these partisan machines that are coming in and saying, hey, you know, Democrats and Republicans could work together. Don't get rid of our system altogether, which is really what I think they're worried about, you know, because I think the younger people are like, not only am I not of a particular party, I'm not of a particular ethnicity, or I'm not favoring a certain ethnicity, or we're testing boundaries of all kinds of things in terms of identity, sexuality, global boundaries and country boundaries. And I just think they're a lot more complex as a voter group, and that in some ways these guys who are fighting for bipartisanship are fighting for partisan identity.
You know, I'll tell you, I saw a lot of young people in the crowds when I saw video and photographs of the demonstration at City Hall yesterday, asking local leaders who knows who to do something about the crew's plans to maybe move to Austin.
Right.
There's an issue for you. And I was wondering if you guys have any ideas if, I mean, there was an article in the Dispatch kind of toying with the idea what local lawmakers would do or if they'd be willing to do something. Jim Siegel?
Yeah, I mean, there is a state capital budget that'll come up next year where if you're going to spend significant state dollars on a stadium of some kind, that would be where you do it. There was mixed reaction to it among some of the local legislators, some liking it, some not. But I mean, but at the end of the day, I'm not convinced yet that it matters.
Yeah.
I mean, I really think Precourt, the owner of the Crew, is on his way out. Mm-hmm. And whether it's Austin or whether it's one of the other cities vying for
be Austin. That's the only out clause he has. But it could be someone after that, somewhere else after that. Right.
But I don't. Yeah. So it I don't know. I don't know that it even matters. I mean, it's just just from the sense I get that, you know, they want the, you know, Major League Soccer wants a team in Cincinnati. Putting a team in Cincinnati and Columbus would not be viable, I don't think. So they have to get rid of Columbus. And so they jettison them to Austin or to wherever it ends up.
For a couple years. And then,
yeah. So they, you know, they want Carl Linder's money down in Cincinnati to own that team. And so I don't know that there's much that, you know, I understand the frustration and I get it that the local leaders are going to try to do everything they can. But I'm not sure any of that's going to make a difference to the Crew owner right now.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When we talked about that last week on the show, one of the analysts I had on said that there's a lot of strong feelings about them going to Austin for a few years, getting another out clause, and then moving to Detroit.
Right.
And I was up in northern Michigan over the weekend, and I heard people talking about that. Big soccer fans in Detroit about what'll it take. And someone said, hey, if they got a soccer team, I'd move back to Detroit. Blah, blah, blah. So,
well, you know, you look at like the Green Bay Packers and owned by the community, you know, and this is the when you have situations like this, you see the real value in having a sports team owned by a community versus one person. And you know, especially if you're asking for tax dollars, which I'm told that that's not the case here. You know, that's what I'm reading.
He doesn't want a freebie.
He's saying he doesn't want a freebie. But if you're asking for a community to help you with money, then I think the thing is that they want some certainty that you're not going to pull out and do this kind of thing.
Anthony Precourt tweeted last week, I really do feel for you Crew fans. It's an uncertain time, I recognize, and I take full responsibility for the situation I have put us in.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice of him to take full responsibility for a situation he's fully responsible for.
Yeah, there were a lot of tweets back at him, too. Not so nice, either.
Because I think he then retweeted right after that and said, oh, I didn't mean us, I meant you.
Did he really?
Yeah, because he knew it sounded really weird to say us. Because, you know, we're in this together.
Yeah.
No, we're not.
You're holding all the cards, dude.
Right.
Yeah.
Just real quick, the Dispatch reported that five former lawmakers have filed a brief with the Ohio Supreme Court arguing that the state education department is violating the legislative intent by requiring the electronic classroom of tomorrow, ECOT, to verify its enrollment and online enrollment. And those same former lawmakers also have a relationship with ECOT. That was something they left out.
Some of them do. Yeah, there were five of them then. One of them is former Speaker Bill Batchelder. His lobbying firm, the Batchelder Company, lobbies for ECOT, or at least did up until I think late July. That group, the group that runs that, I think is now doing other things, so they didn't want to have a conflict there. I think they're actually running DeWine's campaign.
Okay.
For governor, and that he didn't mention that in the brief that he was, and then you've got former Representative Jim Trakas, who at least at this summer worked directly for ECOT and Bill Lager, the founder, and also is now listed as ECOT's lobbyist now that the Batchelder Group is out. Jim
Just
Trakas
a little
is
bit
out.
Of a conflict.
And then you had former Representative Chuck Calvert, whose wife, though not directly related to ECOT, she runs a charter management company, so she is getting money. All her finances coming from the charter world. Just wanted to point out the context of some of the reasons why those
are always nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Siegel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Always happy to do so.
Jim Siegel, Ohio State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Joe Ingles, the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well.
Always fun to be here.
And Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.